This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's your old friend Phil Pritchett here, everyone, on the P2 Podcast, coming to you live on philpritchett.com and radiofreetexas.org. We are sitting in the cozy confines of Trinidad World Recording, my recording studio here in Fort Worth, Texas, guiding you into the mist, a compass always headed in the right direction. Always pointing north, showing you how to navigate these waters so difficult, so fraught with peril, yet rife with opportunity. Isn't that right? Buddy Huffman is here, everybody, from Macon Grayson.
Hello, fans.
Texas' greatest rock band, Macon Grayson. Now America knows. America knows.
You've gone too far.
We covered in the last podcast how Huffman has, and Macon Grayson, they have guys in their band named Harley and Badger and the Falcon and just all these animal names that they've toured. You've been out in California and the Midwest and Texas and the Southeast, you know, talking about touring the nation, rolling into some place with a pool table and a vicinity, a sectioned off portion of the foundation where the band plays. No stage, none required, just to get in there and convert people.
Paying the dues.
With raw energy.
Paying the dues.
Well, Buddy Huffman is here. Thank you, sir, for coming in today.
Hey, Phil, I'm always happy to see you, my friend.
The day find you well.
Always.
Found your way over to the studio, okay?
Found my way over here. I didn't have a lot of I came from Dallas, so not much traffic. Not bad. Had some tunes. You know what I was listening to on the way over?
What's that?
Can't You Hear Me Knocking, Rolling Stones.
Oh, yes. Yes,
man,
of course.
I heard that. I was hearing that on the way over going, Phil said we're going to talk about rock and roll today. That's not a bad way to
start.
That
is a rock and roll song indeed. You know, that's one of those where occasionally when I'm doing a mix or something, I bring it up and just turn it up. And just the tone.
Yeah.
And I read somewhere, I don't know if it's true, that Keith Richards played that. Maybe it was that song. I want to say it was that song. It's just got this fuzzy, and it's like a Fender Twin amp,
yeah,
just like on 10.
Fuzzed completely.
But anybody who plays amps a lot, I mean, a Fender Twin does not break up very easily. They're excessively loud. I mean, you put on about two or three, it's more than you can possibly bear.
Big old 100-watt monster.
Yeah, but if you turn anything on like 10, it's going to distort.
Oh yeah.
So they said he had that out on the floor and just had it on 10.
Well, the tone is
with his Telecaster and just one mic in front of it, and that's how he got it. Now, I don't know if that's true, but I don't know if it was that song, but it was one of those Sticky Fingers tunes.
Well, if you're like, if you have some experience with Fender amps and have played guitar a while, you know that sound when an amplifier is being just
destroyed,
pushed to its limits, and you can hear it.
God bless him.
the tubes, you almost hear the thump of the guitar.
I know.
Yeah, man, it's amazing. Yeah, and that opening riff is just killer.
And you can hear, if you're listening real close, turn up real loud, you can just you can hear just the guitar, the sound kind of bouncing off the room, just the natural room, and you kind of hear Mick in the background go, just as the band comes in. And it's just great, man.
It's a good tune.
The kind of stuff today in today's recording world, people will, you know, they'll mute. So, we'll pull that out of there.
Yeah.
Of course, here at Trinidad, we just leave all that stuff in there.
Hey, man, as it should be.
Well, you know, as one of our old friends, this kid who was recording at the old place in the stockyards, he kind of looked up horrified. A bus went by and somebody screamed out the window. And he said, man, is that going to be on the track? And I just kind of said, probably.
Probably.
He just looked. He just kind of looked shocked. But his record came out very good, I'm proud to say. Well, man, we were talking about Macon Grayson, past, present, and future. Challenges for touring, man. Any of you bands out there, any music fans, you know, what we think about, I don't know, you're going to shows. Yeah, you get tired of paying $15 to go to some theater with 50 people in it.
Yeah.
Man, you may even want to pay $2 or $3, sit on a patio, see a band you don't never heard of. No investment there.
That's what I've
If you like it, you buy a CD maybe.
Right there.
Or a shirt, whatever.
Right there you've hit on something that I really, really, really hope, you know, the future of music is. Because right now, I mean, with the death of the CD and the and the death of the major label and the rise of the internet and podcasts and internet radio stations and satellite radio stations, I mean, this is a unique time, I think, for people to really, and with the economy the way it is too, I mean, who can afford a $15 ticket just for a night out to go see a band? You know, so why not, you know, as just as an audience, you know, I know we're talking to some folks out there in Radio Free Texas and whatnot, you know, start checking out the bands, you know, that are only charging $2, $3, $4, $5 and
That's
give them
right.
a chance, because, you know, the next big band is going to come out of a bar just like that.
That's right. That's right.
You know, there's some really good stuff out there now for, you know, the ticket prices are high, but they're, you know, they're good bands and they you know, they may be worth it. But I really hope that in this period of, you know, recession and kind of economic and social upheaval that, you know, people start to remember that that bands that are huge right now started somewhere and they're out there. Mm-hmm. And for people to kind of change their mindset from, I'm only going to go pay money to see bands I know, to, hey man, I'll put $3 in the kitty to go check out a new band. You know, just let everyone kind of open their ears again to see what's going on. You know, because corporate rock and all that. I mean, it's, the days of that are done.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, save for the dinosaur acts, who can still go out there and charge.
Yeah, but I mean,
$100
again.
But you're right.
An economy like this, who wants to do that?
Yeah. Well, you know, we talk about this is, of course, an issue we approach a lot and from various different angles and in a lot of different examples. On this podcast, this show, you know, you hear guys, and I just remember even in like the 80s, going to like Starplex, you know, in Dallas, or whatever it's called now. It's the Smirnoff or whatever it is. But man, it was, I lost my train of thought. What did I just hear next door here?
I don't know.
Is that
like
a puppy dog? Puppy dog or a cat
puppy
screaming?
Puppy dog or something.
Good grief. Hope that's. Did we get that on tape? I'm going to use that on a record. But man, you know, we'd go see Sting or Guns N' Roses. I mean, huge bands, but man, it was like $10 to sit in the grass.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about the good old days, whatever, like the Fillmore. But really, live music, the Armadillo World Headquarters, are, you know, in Austin back in the 70s or something, Doug Somm and Stevie Ray Vaughan. The whole appeal of live music, or at least clubs, was that it was cheap. It was a cheap night out.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, I mean, you know, that we were talking about the Black Cat with a $2 cover and free hot dogs, dollar Pabst Blue Ribbon. Whereas now it seems like in response to maybe the crunch, in response to some hard times and stuff, the venues, the bands, the agents want more money.
Right.
And the ticket prices get higher. So, well, man, if there are only going to be 100 people come to the show, let's not charge them $8. Let's charge them all 12.
Right.
And man, that is self-destructive, man. And you have to fight to keep those tickets low. And I've had a lot of club guys come to me and say, well, you know, let's raise the ticket price. I'm like, man, until this place is full at $8, we can't justify raising the ticket price. We can't just, the 100 people are going to show up and pay whatever, you know, pay $10. We can't go, well, they'll pay 20 if they'll pay 10. You can't, you just can't do that to your fans. And you're not going to grow your base.
Well, but the other thing about it is too is that, you know, these high ticket prices that are being charged, you know, just as all of the boom bust things have happened and property values reset and, you know, these overinflated values, you know, you get to a period where you have a bust, people start looking, well, wait a minute.
What's something really worth?
Am I getting really value for my money? And in a lot of cases, people are paying $15 tickets and not getting that kind of value for that money. Either a bad show or, you know, they just went there for the party.
That's
and
right.
And not getting, suddenly a $30 party is not so much fun anymore. You know, if you don't like the music and you're not liking what's going on around you. And so, you know, I hope people like that don't get turned off from music and just start to go back out. And, you know, on a $3 ticket, you might see some really phenomenal bands.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I told her, we had a podcast a while back with our friend, this kid, came in. I was talking to Kurt on a podcast. I had a kid come in, look at the studio, who's a big music fan. He's in college right now. And, kind of said, oh, who are you into? I'm expecting to hear the usual suspects list, you know, of, you know, whoever, Ragweed and what have you. But to these young guys, those guys are like Lynyrd Skynyrd or something. That ship has sailed. You know, they're just like almost a ubiquitous huge band that everybody already knows. This guy names, I mean, and this is just in College Station, I mean, names like 30 bands that he follows religiously online and goes to their shows, just playing Fitzwood. I couldn't believe how many there were out there. So it was encouraging. I do think there's more people making music now than ever before.
Oh, there are.
And there are. There's no barriers to recording and
putting
it on iTunes.
Right.
You know, you just kind of, that doesn't cost anything. So, you know, the game is just how to be noticed. But it's like anything done on the cheap, you know, whether you have an unassuming product out there, an album or something. If you're doing it and there's no advertising behind it, for it to succeed, it has to be good. That has to be what happens.
Right. Well, I mean, it all starts with the music. I mean, it has to.
I mean, as opposed to sort of in the old days where, hey, the record kind of sucks, or you see this in films a lot.
Well, they're making singles.
Well, they know the movie's no good before the opening weekend.
Right.
But, man, they hit the Today Show and Letterman. I mean, we got to have a big weekend, a $60 million opening, before everybody goes back and says, man, it was the biggest waste of $10 of my life going to see that movie. They've already made their money. There is the ability still in movies to ram stuff down people's throats when they know they got something bad. And in music, it was like that. If the new Def Leppard or something, man, wasn't up to snuff, they could still take out billboards and run contests and billboards and put them on the highways, and people would still have a big surge at the beginning. But now, without that ability to ram stuff down people's throat, you and I can just have spam blocker and you know, commercialist television at home. We don't need to be exposed to anything.
That's right.
The only way we're going to check something out is if it's good.
Right.
And
or you hear from a friend.
If you tell me, hey, Phil, you got to check these guys out, hey, then I'm interested.
That's right.
But
and
if I get some email from some band, hey, man, download our new stuff or something, I'm not going to be interested in that.
Right.
Unless I've heard that they're good already.
Right. Well, I mean, and that's, I mean, I think the hope. For
permission marketing, I guess you'd
say. Yeah,
you know,
it's kind
like,
of band,
like
the hope for bands like us is that, you know, you get people out there talking about it. Because I think, you know, as the commercialism of the United States has gotten more and more pointed and more obnoxious in many ways, you know, I think people are starting to naturally rebel against it. It's like anything. Too much of a good thing is a bad thing.
It's still too much.
Yeah, and so, you know, bands like us stand a chance in a market like that where, you know, when America's cultural sentiment returns more towards authenticity,
mm-hmm.
I think bands like us and a lot of bands around, you know, within earshot of Radio Free Texas and stuff like that, you know, will hopefully realize that, you know, sincerity matters and the art is really still in the music and not in how it's, you know,
well,
promoted.
And also just there's the ability for guys like us who've never had, you know, just huge machines behind putting us out there. You know, a lot of guys, if you took the machine away, would say, well, man, how am I even going to go play shows or make albums without a big time producer, a bus, you know, an 8-piece band with in-ear monitors? You know, how can we even exist? Cause that's the way they've always operated. So for guys like us who are always just kind of used to, man, we just got to be good and people will tell other people about it.
Right.
And that's kind of the basis. Not that we don't have some radio and some promotions, of course. But at the core of it, you're just kind of hoping it goes on its own a little bit.
Right, but it's still the music has to be great. And, you know, eventually if you keep on knocking, I mean, we were, you know, the funny thing about us, like recent news in the band, you know, we had a song in the movie The Wrestler.
Yeah, that's right. I wanted to address that as well.
Yeah,
now, which song was that? Was that one of your recent records?
It was on our 20th Century Accidents release.
Yeah.
It's a song called Blacklight. And
Black Like the Wrestler, of course, the Academy Award-winning Mickey Rourke movie.
That was an indie film with very little budget and very little, you know, big studio money behind it.
Right. A real comeback for Mickey Rourke had been vanished.
Marissa Tomei is fearless and unbelievably cool.
Yeah.
And hot.
Yeah.
Sorry.
In the film.
That. Yeah. And, you know, there are still champions out there of indie music. You know, people, because we had, you know, it's not like we have any great billing out there in the world, you know, to land a spot on a movie like this. But It happened because some guy heard our stuff and said, hey, it's a good indie rock and roll bar.
Yeah, and you're not going to have to put
a chance.
You're not going to have to put up with a lot of bullshit red tape and license.
Right.
Just, man, how we get this in the movie, just call the guys and say, hey, we'd like to arrange for this and let's make it happen.
And the funny part about it was suddenly, you know, after we get, you know, a song in a movie, the band hasn't changed, the band isn't different, but suddenly this air of legitimacy is bestowed upon you. Wow,
yeah.
They got a song
in
a movie, and that's really a cool thing for a band that's, you know, trying to get by. Hopefully the mentality that I'd like to see just from the band's point of view, you know, from any guys, any band member's point of view, is that, you know, we'll get out of this era of, I'm not going to listen to it unless I've heard of it.
Right.
And kind of get more into the mindset that, you know, just like the economy has to reinvent itself and healthcare has to reinvent itself and all these things have to reinvent themselves, you know, music, I think, really is at a period of reinvention. There's a lot of chaos and noise out there, and it's my hope that, you know, music will start to stand on its own again.
I think it will. We use the term, I talked to you about the blog I read by Bob Lefsetz, the great Lefsetz letter.
Yeah.
He'll send it. You can sign up for that, and he'll send it to you. His thoughts, anything from, but he's in L.A. and connected, and just a lot of talk about, you know, marketing today and the industry today, very cutting edge stuff, and as opposed to kind of the way it was, and just the changing dynamic of the music business.
But it's really
very
funny,
fascinating
with all the technology and all of the you know, reinventions of various, you know, media outlets, whatever. You know, we've really returned to an era, I think we're getting close to it, where, you know, bands are no longer going to be, you know, known by albums and known by press releases and things like that.
Yeah.
I mean, even the concept of an album is starting to completely change now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the pop music people are just putting out singles these days.
Mm-hmm.
Almost, you know, like a 4-song sampler on MySpace or whatever, and they're just putting out these things. So the whole concept of an album is about to almost go bye-bye.
Right.
And, you know, how all this washes out, you know, I couldn't even begin to tell you. But,
yeah,
you know, I think it's a pretty hopeful time for the indie world, for a lot of bands out there in the indie world, because the barriers are all kind of broken down now.
Right.
You know, the record labels are going under right and left. I mean, some of the coolest record shops, Tower.
Sure.
In Dallas, CD World.
Oh, it's gone.
All of the cool places. You know, I know Fort Worth still has a few places still open. Oh, and by the way, Stephen Bruton.
Yes.
Got to give a
the great Stephen Bruton. The
passed late, on
late,
to the higher
great,
plane just
late,
recently.
Great Stephen Bruton.
He played on our first record.
That's right. Yeah, I think
Stephen
I remember that.
Stephen played on our first record. So isn't it his brother that has the record shop in town?
Sumter Bruton, yeah, over at Record Town across from
Record
TCU.
Town.
Yeah, that's
Very
right.
Cool.
That's right.
But, you know, I mean, places like that are becoming fewer and fewer and farther between.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, that's not always a bad thing. Sometimes you got to burn it down to rebuild it. And hopefully, you know, when music comes out of this era of, you know, whatever it's in.
Well, you wonder, I mean, back,
you know, things
in
will start to get back to.
Yeah.
The bands are
well,
good.
Like Lefsetz says.
Little Steven.
Yeah.
Did you see a South by Southwest, the little speech he gave?
No, uh-uh.
He lambasted rock and roll.
Oh, yeah?
Saying that, you know, these bands these days come out, they have one hit, and they leave. They have no craft. They have no art.
No.
You know, the days of the bar band going out and playing, and people just, you know, they don't know the band, but they're playing a good rhythm, and so I'm going to get out of my seat, and I'm going to dance and have a good time. You know, bands
That's right.
don't really foster that.
Right.
That type of relationship with the audience anymore. And the audience is not giving back either. And so, you know, I really hope that, you know, both the bands can start to think of their audiences and say, hey, you know, I need to put on a good show.
Right, right.
There's no need. You know, I can put on a great show my own way. I don't have to be a big mouth. I don't have to wear flashy clothes, but I can
That's
put
right.
on a great show.
I think it's right. That there's no doubt that right now music does not drive the culture, and that's Lefsetz's term. drive the culture like it did in the 60s or the 70s. You know, if you wanted to know where things were headed, where society was located, you listen to the new Dylan album or whatever, fill in your favorite band. It was just on the cutting edge. And nowadays, man, really, you know, people don't stand in line for the albums anymore. They stand in line to buy an iPhone. They stand in line. It's that technology, man, right, where people want to be. And you wonder, man, I'm like you. We all love music and stuff, but it'll be interesting to see how it all shakes out and if somebody can bring it back. But, you know, it's always darkest before the dawn. You go back to where, you know, Nirvana really broke through or the Sex Pistols. I mean, the Sex Pistols, yeah, disco. I mean, music was done, you know, before you had sort of a resurgence of some raw energy.
And you do, and I think a lot, you know, of it is also...
You had hair metal, you had Paula Abdul in the 80s, and you just thought, man, this is just how music's going to be forever. But, man, one day, I'll never forget when I saw the Smells Like Teen Spirit video, I go, yeah, dude, that's like a real band in a garage. Where do they find these? How did they get in here? Who let those guys in, you know? How did they get on here? And I think it's man, the opportunity is right there. And it's going to be some kid makes a record in his dorm room and just has millions of downloads where he sells like a whole album for like a dollar or something, just crazy. And everyone's going to be like, man, this guy's got $3 million. Wait, how did this happen? He's 17. What? How did this happen? Yeah. So, man, he's got cool music, but he also has this a great site that really caters to his fans. Just something, man. It'll be something that we don't know what it is now, you know?
Well, I mean, but it's still, it's still the music, though. It's still music-driven. And if you look back at all the big music revolutions, you know, you're talking about in the 90s, coming out of the hair metal era, but there was also, you know, the start of Iraq War I, and there was, you know, a lot of financial concerns. I mean, that's how, you know, Bush Sr. got knocked out of office because he realized, hey, we got massive deficits. We need taxes. The economy's in the tank. It's funny, you know, society responds to the times that they're in. And we've gone through this extraordinary period of just financial.
Yeah.
Just maximalism. Everyone's making money hand over fist.
And, yeah, right, right.
You know, people are just, you know, you can't have enough yachts. You can't have enough boats. And then this big, you know, this big Wall Street crash happens.
That's right.
I think that in response to those kinds of things, you've noticed a lot of these high-dollar, glitzy, super-pop touring things have shut down.
Yeah, well, there's no doubt, yeah.
And I think that you're going to see, you know, the return of a little bit of good old-fashioned American...
Yeah, rootsy, get in the van, get out there and play.
Good
and,
old-fashioned Americanism, you know, where people are, you know, picking themselves by the
from the roots, man. The roots
going
rockers.
Going back to the roots of it. You know, no matter what your political stripe is, I could give a shit. But it's back to that old, you know, hey, this is authentic...
It has value.
It's creative.
Hey, man,
it's
$3 and a $2 beer.
Yeah.
I'm in. $5 to go check out a band, you know, or something like that.
And I think in an atmosphere like that, I think a band like us, a band like you, bands that are, you know, running around in our circles, I think they've got a chance.
Yeah.
To really, you know, get noticed. I mean, and I don't even know if it's going to necessarily be new bands. It could be a new band like you're talking about, but it could be a band that's been doing this.
Oh, forever.
Four, five, ten, whatever. I mean, look at My Morning Jacket. How many albums have they made and toiled, and how long have they been out there doing their thing? And then suddenly, Rolling Stone does an article and says, this is one of the best records I've ever heard.
Yeah, that's right.
And then a band like that that's been kicking itself around for 10 years suddenly gets its due.
That's right.
And I think
every overnight success is 10 years in the making,
And I think that the atmosphere in music is rife for that kind of thing to happen.
Fraught with danger and rife with opportunity, folks. Well, that's some talk with Buddy Huffman here from Macon Grayson. So gracious to join us to drive over from Dallas today.
Hey, and, man, a cup of coffee and some Rolling Stones
tunes.
I'm there.
Talking about the Stones and Sunvolt and stuff like that. Well, we're going to keep talking where music's headed. And we also want to talk about, I want to hear about Buddy. I love hearing everybody's stories about kind of how they get going in music. Like way back to, you know, Mom's Guitar, and I had this Neil Diamond album or whatever, you know, gets guys going very, very early on. So we're going to share some stories about Buddy's influences, some of my early influences as well. I don't know how we both got started playing music. In the next segment when we get back.
Doesn't want to tell the truth, so she smiles into the phone. She doesn't mention all the setbacks and the callbacks.
fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast. Email us, phil@philpritchard.com, or just call my phone. It's just right here, sitting on my desk right now. 817-733-5256. Ring that phone, I will answer. Tell us when we can come play. Phil Pritchard and the full band, when you and your band would like to come record. Even if you don't have a band, we'll get Stu and Blue, man, the full band, come in here and play on your stuff. Whatever. We make music, that's what we do. The great Buddy Huffman is here.
Peace.
From Macon Grayson. We've been talking about where music's headed. It's fun to get a new guest in here. We got Kurt South in here all the time. We're always covering obscure territory, you know, different topics, wide range.
Kurt's crazy.
Kurt is a crazy man, but always very opinionated.
Of course.
Very well spoken. So it's great to have a buddy here because I'm able to kind of refresh a lot of the ground we cover a lot on the podcast, but get someone else's perspective on it. And Buddy has more than provided that.
What's the twisted hippie
thing? Last week and this week. We were talking about, you know, where music may be headed, the death of the album, the death of rock and roll, etc. But where did you? I wanted to know. I'm always curious, just as a musician, a fan. Where was your first experiences with music? You know, did you grow up in a musical family, or were you? Where'd you kind of get turned on to the whole thing?
Well, there was music in. So most of my family is actually from Tennessee, and there was the I think there was a fiddle player in the past, and some other people like that. But my parents were. Riding around, we only had one car when I was a kid, so, you know, we'd get up in the morning and take my dad to work, and on the way to work, there was always music playing, and then, you know, on the way around town doing errands and stuff, there was always music playing, and my mom was a big fan of, you know, 70s rock, really.
Sure, yeah.
And so that's where it started, and then, you know, as I grew up, I mean, I, you know, was part of the MTV generation, so music videos had a lot to do with what we watched and stuff.
But jumping on your bed with a tennis racket kind of deal?
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. The big tennis rackets. I only had a wooden one.
Yeah, right. That's more authentic, vintage acoustic guitar style.
But my mom had this this Mexican bazaar style acoustic guitar with gut strings. It was probably worth $10.
Yeah.
And I found it one day just kind of trolling through the house. And, you know, of course, every kid seen MTV and wants to be a rock star. So talked my parents into, you know, giving me lessons. Of course, I wasn't allowed to have an electric guitar.
Now, what grade was this? At what age? About
13.
13, yeah.
So I had to learn on this terrible guitar, and I want, you know, you want to be a rock star. So
that's right, man.
You try.
Like, just give me a
Les Paul.
To
lobby for a Christmas present, you know. I wanted give me a guitar and an amp, and I never stuck with it long enough to warrant them buying me, you know, the electric guitar and the amp. So, I mean, that was pretty much the end of my early rock and roll career,
lessons, though?
I did. I took a
learned
few lessons.
Learned a few chords.
Got the Mel Bay chord book.
Every
beginning guitarist has been given the Mel Bay book of chords.
Did you go somewhere for lessons or somebody come to your house?
Yeah, some guy in Plano.
Yeah.
I didn't really know. The first song I ever learned was, he was a big fan of that I guess they called corporate rock of the 70s, Boston.
Yeah, yeah.
Things like that. And so I think he taught me more than the feeling.
Yeah.
I learned a Barracuda.
Yeah.
I learned of Heart Barracuda. But, I mean, that really wasn't what I was terribly interested in at that time. You know, I wanted to
do the
NXS and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Rock and bands like that. And so, anyway, guitar lessons went the way. And
so all through high school, were you messing with playing music or not? Not too much?
Not at all.
Yeah, wow.
Not at all.
Okay.
And, I mean, I listened to it, but I wasn't playing it or even entertaining thoughts of doing it.
Right.
Got to college, and of course, you start learning about the obligatory college bands that are the cool underground stuff, you know.
Where'd you go to school?
University of Texas in Austin.
Oh, okay, all right.
So, you know, all the...
So you were in Austin, so you were there, when I was kind of in school. I mean, you were down there early 90s.
Yeah, that's right.
90 to 94 or 5
that's
in there.
That's right.
So you're down there in Austin, and God, did you go to those Soul Hat gigs at the Black Cat? Were you into that whole scene?
Funny story.
I was probably there if you were.
The lead singer of Soul Hat, Kevin McKinney.
Yeah.
Went to high school with that guy.
Well, he went to Southwestern when I went to college.
Yeah.
So McKinney was there.
Right, because I hadn't seen him yet. The last time I'd seen him was in high school.
He's a Houston guy, right?
No, he's from Dallas, from Plano.
Oh, that's right, from Plano. That's right.
Last time I saw him, he had short hair and was wearing a rugby shirt and jeans and
you
know, looking the part of the average white kid.
Plano.
And I see him a few years later. You know, we're walking down 6th Street in Austin, Black Cat, and I look up on stage and I see this guy's face, and I'm just like, I know that guy. And I walked in, and it was freaking Kevin McKinney up there playing. And I think they were had just done Bone Crusher, an album called Bone Crusher, something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that was kind of later. Their early stuff, man. McKinney had some great, talk about just fun, great funky riffs.
Yeah, big time.
Songs like, you know, Skinny Dippin' and Over Easy.
So
My Baby Likes Me Sunny Side Up.
We became fans of those guys. We'd go down and see them. They play, like, had a weekly, I think they had a weekly gig down there at Black Cat.
They played every Thursday and Saturday or something,
something like that.
Yeah. And it turned into a scene, man.
That's how I kind of got into it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Liberty Lunch was still open back then.
Yeah. Steamboat.
Some of those places, yeah, absolutely. Maggie Mays was there. But the Liberty Lunch was where my first, like, real, I went and saw In Living Color and Driving and Crying.
Really? I've got Driving and Crying album over there.
I had never seen, I knew of In Living Color because of the Cult of Personality.
So right,
it was
right.
Huge on the radio, but didn't know Driving and Crying. And we'd gotten there, and it was a midnight show, but we didn't know that. So we show up at like...
Texas music fans would know that Corey Morrow covered that song.
Yeah. So we show up...
I'm going straight to hell. That's Driving and Crying, man. It's
these
not
guys,
Corey Morrow. Great song.
We showed up at like 9 o'clock. Place was empty. We couldn't figure out what the hell was going on. I was like, where is everybody? Turned out it was going to be a midnight show. So anyway, we'd already paid and gone in. There was no in and outs. So we're stuck in this place.
Sit there for three hours.
So we sat there for several hours, me and three of my buddies, and just drank and talked to the bartender until about 11:30. People started showing up, and we got up at the front of the stage, and I watched In Living
Color.
Man, right in front of...
Living Color, man. I saw them open for the Stones in 89.
Right in front of Vernon Reed's guitar.
Yeah, just cranking away.
He's just tearing my head off, and I'm just loving every second of it. And, you know, I started to really... enjoy live music and kind of fall in love with it. Went to a lot of shows. And
who else did you go see? That? Did you go to some shows? Gosh. Liberty Lunch? I mean,
old band. One of my favorite bands out of that era was a band called Two Hoots and a Holler.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That was back when they were cool, and we used to go see them all the time.
It Broussard. Rick Broussard, was he the lead singer of that?
Man, I can't remember.
Two Hoots.
That's where one of the funniest things I've ever heard.
They were a staple Austin kind of rockabilly band, sort of.
Yeah,
right? I mean,
kind of rockabilly.
Rocking.
Kind of Fastball was down there at that time.
Yeah,
I believe.
Yeah.
But
Miles Zuniga's band,
Two Hoots and a Holler, man. I went and saw him one night, and he's like, they're playing at some bar in Austin. He's like, man, this place sucks. He goes, I'm sick and tired of playing in fern bars. And he left. I thought that was the coolest thing ever.
And tired of playing in what?
Fern bars.
What does that mean?
Well, with bars where there's ferns hanging.
Fern bar. Okay.
So
I played several fern bars. I didn't know they were a category.
A fern bar. So he says this and walks
what
off.
What venue was that?
I can't even remember the name of it. And I had my cousin
like
had come
Egos
from,
or somewhere? Or?
No, it was, no. This was on 6th Street.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I brought my cousin from the University of Tennessee. She had come down to visit me.
Yeah.
I was like, man, you got to go see this band. They're really cool. And so they played their first set, got back up, played a couple songs. And he goes, man, I'm sick and tired of playing this, this
fern bar.
Fucking fern bar.
I'm out.
I started dying laughing. Yeah. My cousin's looking at me like, what is going on here?
He just walks out, huh?
He just left. He
Two Hoots. Oh, man.
So Austin was such a cool place to see music. It's just so many interesting bands. And that was back when South by Southwest was just getting started. Ryan Adams came down in like 93, something like that.
I sat on the front row for like Matthew Sweet and some guys like that.
Yeah.
A wristband to go to everything was like $20.
Yeah, it was like $20.
$20. Now it's, I don't know what it is, hundreds.
And it was, and it was what it was supposed to be. It was unsigned bands
guys.
And record labels. It was a chance for the record labels to maximize their time, see all the bands at once, and a way for the bands that didn't have labels to come in and at least get seen.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, in some way. And that's what the purpose of South by Southwest always had been.
Yeah, right.
Nowadays, it's a big corporate event,
it's just where,
things evolve.
Stone Temple Pilots announces their reunion tour or something, and so they do a set. Or just something.
It's
like,
turned into
whatever.
More of a media event than what it was originally. But, you know, that's when I was there in Austin, and it was a really great time. And so when I got to graduate, I went to graduate school, and, I was studying all the time, studying odd hours of the day and night. And
were you down there in Austin as well?
No, I'd come back to Dallas.
Oh, Dallas. Okay, yeah, right. So you're in graduate school. What were you studying there?
Molecular biology.
Good grief, folks. You think he had a cerebral edge to him? A well-spoken intelligence? Let me tell you what. Molecular biology.
He's lying.
Goodness gracious.
So I was getting
You're the first person who's ever been on this podcast.
I got my PhD in molecular biology. So while I was doing it, though, you'd study for a few hours, and then you'd have to stop because at least I do. I can't go for hours upon hours. I have to stop and brain has to reset.
Yeah.
So
how do we get this far into the podcast without talking about your PhD in molecular biology? But here we are.
Because no, I don't think people believe me.
Yeah, right.
I think they think I'm lying to them.
They see you at the bar grabbing a beer, smoking a cigarette.
There he is. Kicking over your amp. At the bar smoking a cigarette, drinking a beer, and this guy's
supposed to know about the compounds of the human skin. Talk to that guy. Okay, so you're in graduate school.
Yeah, so I started
music.
Playing,
you know,
so I started.
Were you still going to see bands though and stuff? I mean, you're still not really.
I had stopped. Because I didn't have time or money for that matter. So I started playing guitar just kind of in off times when I wasn't studying, just kind of as a decompression thing.
Sure.
And I kept playing, and met a guy who was writing his own songs, and just thought, this guy's the coolest guy in the world.
Yeah,
he's just a buddy of mine. This guy's cool. He's writing his own songs.
Yeah, he's made up.
I'll write my own songs, and I started doing it.
Who was that?
A guy named Terry Catlett.
Terry, okay.
He was in a band that I was in long, long time ago called the Front Porch Boys.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty much a Robert Earl Keen kind of cover band.
I guess we were.
And I think Robert Earl owes us some royalties for that because we did spread the word for that guy.
Yeah, he really kicked his career into high gear, huh?
It was
give
us.
Give him a few shout-outs on the show.
We're going to take credit for it. But no, but anyway, he and I were, you know, writing our own stuff and just kind of getting our feet wet and wrote my first song. I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world.
Yeah, fun to do.
And just kept doing it. And then we wound up playing at Monday nights down at 8 Airs. Back when Jack used to play Tuesdays a long time ago.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
And
Ingram, how long you do that as Tuesday nights at 8 Airs?
He did it for a lot of years. Well, he was in school at SMU.
He played there every Tuesday night.
And so while I was in school, in graduate school, I started doing Monday nights with Terry. We'd just go up there and play, you know, Robert O'Keefe songs and other stuff we liked and maybe some new random songs we wrote. And
Pass the tip jar.
We got a free burger and a pitcher of beer. And that's how it went. And we did that for a number of years. And then moved up to Fridays. Lois, the old owner of 8 Airs, didn't even have music on Friday and Saturday. It used to be only Monday through Thursday.
Is that right?
We were the first band.
Was the weekend kind of
built-in
crowd?
Weekend was jukebox only, built-in crowd, pool tables, whole nine yards.
Yeah.
So we were the first band to ever play a Friday night
gig at 8
Airs.
Is that right?
A standing, we played every Friday at 8 Airs for years, two, 3 years.
Is that
right?
That long?
Yeah, man.
Grief.
Yeah, man. And then after that, you know, we did that first record with Ray, with Ray Hubbard, and...
And that was still you and Terry playing?
No, the Front Porch Boys had split up somewhere.
Gotcha.
During the 3 or so years that we played every Friday at 8 Airs, the Front Porch Boys split up.
Right.
I stayed with the gig and just picked up some other guys.
Right.
And then it was just kind of playing every week. The band, you know, was a little different. I mean, there was kind of a solid core group of people, but...
Yeah, but you and just whoever could make it out.
Yeah, it was
out.
Just yeah, kind was, of more of a fun jam. We played covers and stuff we knew, and just kind of started to learn how to play music live.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was how I learned, was from these older guys that had way more experience than I did. And
right.
Taught me a lot about it.
And around this time when you've gotten to the Ray Hubbard deal, Ray Wiley Hubbard produced your first album.
Yeah, so we had some original tunes, and the bass player had played in Ray's band. Said, hey, man, Ray's a friend of mine, you know, and he's looking to maybe get into production. Would you be interested in doing a record with him? I'm like, sure, well, I really don't have a band. I mean, the band didn't exist.
Right.
And so that's when we went down and recorded it, and Stephen Bruton played on it. Paul Piercy, Terry Ware, a bunch of really good Austin musicians played on that record.
That's Richmond,
John Mastin.
And the great Stephen Bruton.
And the great, Bruton was phenomenal.
Those of you Stephen Bruton was a, he passed away here recently.
Very
but
recently.
A Fort Worth guy. I don't know, I think he was born and raised here in Fort Worth.
Yeah, I think he's
His brother Sumter Bruton owns the Record Town. A lot of people know who've been around Fort Worth, straight across the street from TCU Record Town. His family's owned that building for a lot of years. His mother still works in there. It's Sumter Bruton. And Stephen Bruton, great guitar player, played with Chris Christopherson.
Played with Dylan.
Everyone played with Dylan.
I think he played with Bonnie Raitt.
Bonnie Raitt. I think he produced some Bonnie Raitt records. I don't know if he produced Nick of Time, that big Oscar. I don't know if he did that one, but I think he might have played on it.
That guy, you know, I when he came to play in the studio with us, I really had no idea who he was. I really didn't know. And he's
kind of a quiet guy.
Very quiet, very unassuming, not arrogant in the least, but just a freaking musical tactician. He got in there, listened to the skeleton of what we laid down, and just
jot out a few
picked
notes.
Up a guitar, started, you know, he went off by himself for like 20 minutes and started kind of noodling, called Ray in there and called me in there and said, hey man, do you like this idea? And he put together this really cool riff to go with this song, which was just a simple 3-chord song. Now it sounds cool.
Now it sounds like,
holy cow, this guy just turned what was a simple song into something really, really cool.
He's amazing player, producer. He was also later on, of course, he died at T-Bone Burnett's house. I'd read. He was there out there working on a record together. The great, also another Fort Worth guy, T-Bone Burnett, the great legendary producer of so many, Counting Crows, Elvis Costello, yeah. The Wallflowers, good grief, the Oh Brother Where Art Thou soundtrack,
yeah.
Robert Plant, Alison Krauss. Anyway, a great Fort Worth legend, man.
Yeah.
Stephen Bruton. He played on your record, man. That's really cool.
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, man.
He played also, Austin folks will remember he was a standard at, Bob Schneider started doing the Lonely Land shows at Mondays at the Saxon Pub.
Yeah.
I think Bruton, maybe he still does.
Well, Bruton used to play.
And Bruton was in the band. He was in the Lonely Land band.
He played on Sunday nights, too, with a band called The Resentments.
That's right. That's right.
And those guys were fantastic.
Yeah.
Ray, that's the first time Ray really gave me a musical education. Ray Wiley Hubbard is a, the miles.
So
the,
Ray was sort of your mentor maybe starting out into this
absolutely.
Deal?
Absolutely. I mean,
what'd you glean from Ray Wiley Hubbard being around him a little bit?
You know.
What kind of guy is he?
Ray is.
Of course, he's clean. He's a very, very level-headed guy and so nice.
But he has such a past. He has such a past.
Oh, man. Oh, no doubt.
Because he was, in the wild, wild west days of the Willie Nelsons.
Now, he came out of kind of, he was up there in like.
He's out of Dallas.
Out of Dallas, but he was lived in northern New Mexico. Wasn't he out in that whole scene? Did he play out there a lot or something?
I don't know so much about that. I mean, he may have. I don't know.
But, yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, he really came out of the wild west of the Waylon Jennings days and the Armadillo World Headquarters, that whole. He was the Dallas guy in that bunch, of course, he wrote one of the great Jerry Jeff Walker anthems of all time, Up Against the Wall, Redneck Mother.
Absolutely.
And the stories.
The song is by Ray Wiley Hubbard.
Yeah, and the stories that Ray has about the old days, he's told me some of the funniest tour bus stories I've ever heard in my life. Stuff about tour buses catching on fire and tour buses rolling down Sixth Street on their own because they didn't set the brake.
Yeah, right.
Just really, really. And Ray, if anyone's ever been to a Hubbard show, you know that Ray is one of the best storytellers.
Hilarious.
Out there.
He told the often repeated story about the guy, the ketchup bottle at the show. Is that his famous, where he finishes the song, no one's clapping, and finally after one song he hears a. And he starts to look over and say, "Oh, thanks!" And it's the guy just hitting the bottom of a ketchup bottle.
Oh yeah, Ray has a million of those stories.
A million. Funny.
And when we recorded that album, I stayed at his house out there in Wimberley, and with his wife and his son Lucas, who plays guitar for him now.
Yeah, that's right.
And
his wife kind of managed his career.
Judy.
And
they were the nicest people to me. They just treated me like I was.
Man, he's such a nice guy. We were playing a show with him, and he. Just didn't have to do it, man. We played and we're throwing our stuff in the van, and he just comes walking up, and I didn't even recognize him at first. He had kind of a big hat on. He just goes, "Hey, man, I just love your set, man. That's some great stuff, And
Ray's just
very cool. I go, "Man, I really appreciate you saying that." He didn't have to do that. I wouldn't have sought him out at all. Always brushes his teeth before a gig. You ever been around it? He talked about he needed to go brush his teeth. He goes, "Oh, I brush my teeth before every show." I remember I kind of looked over at Stolly or something like, there's a little fun fact for you.
Yeah, Ray's he's a really interesting guy. But like I said, the thing about him is he's really a down-to-earth, genuine dude.
A great mentor, man. The kind of a guy that you got around early on. Named Macon Grayson, came up with that name for the band.
That's right, named the band.
Produced the record. And brought in Stephen Bruton.
Introduced me to all these just phenomenal musicians. Like I said, Paul Piercy played drums for Jeff Walker for years and played with a bunch of other really great bands. And, it was definitely an education early on. And I think the thing that Ray taught me the most, is that, you just kind of need to be yourself, and you need to be who you are, and you need to, tell it from your point of view. And, that really made a difference to me, because the next record, I'm more of a rocker.
Yeah.
And, I had those words in my head, you need to be who you are and what you are. And he really, like I said, he was a mentor, probably in more ways than he would even agree to recognize.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah.
And he was a great, like I said, and I haven't talked to him a lot in recent years, but, every once in a while, I'll run into him or get an email from somebody and just,
Man,
he named the band, so we.
And even of course he's known for his classic stuff, man. But he's in recent years, man, has just had some really cool. I love that rock and roll is a vicious game. Mm. Have you heard that single?
Oh yeah,
that song. God, man, it's just hilarious, man.
He's lived it.
Rock and roll is a vicious game.
He's lived it, and that's the thing with Ray. That's again, we've talked about it the last time the last podcast is that authenticity is important, and Ray. Ray was always, the things he wrote about, there was an authentic
Yeah.
You know, it was real. It was part of his experience. And
that's right.
And, you know, he, various incarnations and phases of his life, you know, he was, I think he was always kind of true to what he was.
That's right.
And that's to be appreciated, you know, from my perspective. And I'm glad I saw that early on. Because I think it probably prevented me from making a whole bunch of artistic mistakes, you know, not being true.
Well, you know, starting out, you want it so hard to be accepted. You want it so hard for anyone who's maybe you consider a peer who's out there to hear your stuff and go, man, that guy's really good. And Ray knows, as any good songwriter knows, man, you've got to have the balls to be unique and to stand on your own. I see guys come in here a lot, man, and their stuff, and they're trying their best, but you can see that, man, they're trying to sound like Reckless Kelly or somebody, or they have that, and it takes a while to find your voice for anybody.
You're exactly right. I mean, what you say, I think the last part of what you said is something that is most important, and that is, you know, it takes a while to develop a craft. It takes while to develop, you know, your own voice. And
I wanted to sound like the Beatles. I wanted to sound like John Lennon, you know, but I just had a deep Texas drawl of a voice, and
that's the
was
key.
Too into kind of country and rock and roll to. And just after a while, you just go, well, that's just what I sound like then, you know. And
right, exactly.
Once you embrace that, you can start doing something, as you guys have done, you know.
Yeah.
And you and embrace your own sound.
Yeah, and even though Ray is dramatically different from what we sound like, you know, I still, you know, I consider him, you know, a mentor and part of that that evolution, you know. We needed to sound like what we needed to sound like, and then he, you know, kind of gave me permission and said, hey, it's cool. You just need to be who you are.
Yeah. Well, man, that's a... some great catching up there, man. I love hearing kind of the backstories, how you get going, band, any artist get going. It's so cool that Stephen Bruton, the late, great Stephen Bruton, and Ray Wilde Hubbard were a big part of your upbringing.
They were part of my, when I was just...
formative years. Your formative years, Huffman.
When I was a dumb kid, man. Those guys taught me.
Well, you were in good hands. You were in good hands, my friend. Well, man, we were talking about touring the Midwest.
Yeah.
Playing shows, being a rock band, playing good stuff in the 80s, something that maybe some people would argue is hard to find. But we're going to prove there's a lot of exceptions to that, because we're going to look at a band that rocked in the 80s and was fantastic. To this day, they've even put out some really great records recently. We're going to look at the great album Learning to Crawl by the Pretenders and what's on P2's iPod when we come back. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Email me, for crying out loud, phil@philpritchett.com. Let us know what you need to hear discussed on the podcast. Or call me. My phone's right here in the other room, 817-733-5256. Let me know when the full band can come play a show for you, or when you want to come record at Trinidad World Recording. We'd love to have you. I'd love to talk to you. With me today is the great Buddy Huffman from Macon Grayson. Thanks for coming in, Buddy.
Hey, man.
Well, man, we were talking on the last podcast about rock and roll bands, chicks that rock. Of course, Chrissy Hynde. Is there maybe a better example of a gal who can get out and kick out the jams than Chrissy Hynde?
Man,
the Pretenders, man.
Chrissy Hynde, in my pantheon of the female rockers.
Oh, man.
Three of them stand out to me.
Bring
Chrissy Hynde,
yes.
Of course. Stevie Nicks, of course. And Patti Smith.
There you go, man.
Those girls could bring it.
They can
Chrissy
bring
Hynde
it.
Chrissy Hynde can freaking bring it.
Dude, just a Telecaster,
boots,
tight jeans.
And an
still
attitude.
Has, much like the great guy rockers that we, you know, Tom Petty or someone, she's had just kind of the same look.
Yep.
You know, she hadn't gone through a bunch of trendy, you know, I mean, they came out, I'm trying to see when that... Learning to Crawl was 1983. They had a couple records before this, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Pretenders 1 and 2, I think they were. And so late 70s, you know, 79, 80, the Pretenders kind of came out. I think she's from the Midwest, Ohio, I believe. And just a great rock band, mm-hmm. a lot of incarnations. Certainly had a, I think the drummer had died or drug overdose. It was kind of the deal where she was dating the bass player or the drummer, one of the guys. They started the band. And then she was quickly kind of seen as sort of the star, the person of the band. And so the Pretenders got going there. A staple on MTV earlier on, you had the Brass and Pocket video. You probably remember. Is that the one where she's the waitress?
I think so, yeah.
Dan, 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 dan,
yeah, that's exactly. Dan, dan.
Yeah, so Chrissy always kind of had the black hair, the boots, the Telecaster. Great stuff. Man, I remember reading that she was... of course, they did a great cover of the old Kinks song. You're a big Kinks fan, buddy.
I am.
The Kinks. Talk about a zany rock band we could do a whole show on.
You could do several shows on the Kinks.
Some of you hardcore country guys on Radio Free Texas, God love you, run for cover when the Kinks show comes along. But greatness in there, man. There's a lot in there for you on the Kinks.
The fearless.
Muswell Hillbillies. Fearless artistic rock. But she was involved, Chrissy Hynde. I remembered knowing this, and I was reading their page earlier. She was involved with Ray Davies, mm-hmm. the genius behind the Kinks. Of course, they did a great... What Kinks song did they do? It is time for you to stop all your sobbing. They did a cover of that. But this one, man, has a lot of the... this is a great Pretenders. If you don't have the Pretenders... and you don't want to get the greatest hits. I'm real anti-greatest hits on the iPod.
Yeah.
I liked having the album on there. Because the greatest hit, then you get like four or five of the same song.
Well, I mean, in that era, they were making albums. So,
that's right.
And that was their, that was their vision. So, yeah, it's a good idea to try to, at least on your first listen, to, listen to the whole record. Because they did, they really did things for a reason and on purpose. And album, the concept of album music.
Yeah.
Is kind of foreign right now. But records like this, it's almost better that they're on vinyl, because then you have to start it, and it becomes a pain in the ass to jump around and find another song.
Oh,
so you're almost compelled to sit and listen to it in one in one listen, so you only have to get up once to flip it over.
Yeah, absolutely, man.
And it's a great album.
It's a great album. Learning to Crawl. You had Chrissy Hynde, of course, on vocals. Martin Chambers was the drummer and vocalist. Robbie McIntosh, guitar and vocals. And Malcolm Foster, bass guitar and vocals. There's some killer bass lines on this. I love the... Of course, the one a lot of people recognize is My City Was Gone. Another great bass line is to be found on Time the Avenger.
Man, the whole record is full of those kind of Brit pop, cool, groovy bass lines. The guitar player for that band, and Chrissy was a guitar player herself.
Yeah, that's right.
The rhythm, the way they did the rhythm, like that track you just played a minute ago, Middle of the Road.
Yeah.
That repeated. It's a cool riff, and it's just all built up in layers. And that's when.
Yeah.
That's when you have craft, and that's what,
Well, she's one of the few, man, that it seems like that, of course, anybody, any artist always seems to, there's such a fine line. Me and South have approached this on the podcast before. There's such a fine line between the artist that, they're always evolving and reinventing themselves.
Yeah.
There's a fine line between that and they're always being trendy and following whatever's trendy.
Right.
I don't know where you draw the line. I don't know if you can say that, you know, Madonna has reinvented them. U2 has reinvented themselves. Is that what Madonna's doing, or is she just kind of being trendy? Maybe it's like you say, it just comes back to the music. If the music's good, maybe you excuse any way the band looks.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard to say. It's really, and you know, I mean, that's always the big talk about this is a sellout and that's a sellout. And
yeah.
I think, you know, a lot of times you have to be careful in those judgments because they, you know, and I'm just talking about the population in general, you know, like,
right.
You know, take someone like Pat Green.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people after he started getting really popular,
yeah,
you know, called him a sellout.
As we've discussed in this podcast,
called
before,
him this
right.
and that and the other. But the fact of the matter is, Pat never really changed his sound. He still, I mean, he had a sound he started
yeah.
with, and he's doing it, and he's always done it. It's just mm-hmm. the whole notion of fame and fortune suddenly changes your perspective on it. And,
it does. That's right.
And it's, you know, it's disingenuous of people to think that about him because he's the same guy he's always been. He's
Man.
Playing
yeah. Yeah.
his own brand of country music. It may not be your style.
Yeah.
He may not be covering topics you consider interesting or insightful, but it doesn't matter. I mean, that's what he was doing.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, it is interesting that an era that comes up a lot is sort of the late 70s, really the disco era.
Yeah.
That just where, man, everyone from Elton John to Rod Stewart to the Stones had a hard time fighting through and just really wouldn't emerge till like the early 90s with anything decent. It just sort of really changed. The Pretenders really seemed to benefit, and I'm just kind of... They really came on at the end of disco. They started making a name for themselves really like 80, 81. When MTV came out, you did have rock bands out there like Petty and these guys.
Yeah.
And, hey, here was this cool chick, you know, Chrissy Hynde and her mm-hmm. band, The Pretenders. Had some videos. Back on the Chain Gang was a big hit. That's on Learning to Crawl as well. Brass in Pocket, I think it was from their one of their earlier records, the first album, was their first real big hit. And, yeah, man, this record kicks off with Middle of the Road. And just one of my favorite Pretender songs. That's probably one. And that starts off the album. Just a great guitar. Just
a straight up and down rock and roll tune. No frills, no thrills.
But
when you listen to these albums, you know, and that's kind of the funny thing about craft and art. You know, these young artists that sound like these other bands.
Uh-huh.
You know, if you listen to that record, I mean, you hear the layers of what they're doing. You know, you've got a drum
yeah.
but then you've got this killer bass line. Then you've got this rhythm guitar riff that's pushing it
great
along.
Great guitar tones, yeah.
Then you've
yeah.
got the harmonica, then the vocals. I mean, these things are layered up and put together in a very specific way. I mean, it's you know,
mm-hmm.
it's incredible to hear what they were doing back, you know, put this in the frame of reference of when it was put out.
Yeah, you're right.
And you
very,
start to,
very
and you,
different.
And you start to realize, you know, this is
rootsy.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a sellout at all. All this is what they'd always done.
Right.
Except
yeah.
this time, people were paying attention. And maybe something different about the songs caught them, but they're not, you know what I mean? So it's that whole
yeah.
era of, they tried the disco thing, you know, like all these other bands tried disco, but I don't know if it's so much of a, I think it's, they're just kind of exploring new music.
Yeah.
And maybe the ideas caught them
in a certain way. Yeah.
I mean, you know, in a certain type of way, and then you're like, hey, I want to kind of try that and sound like that.
What I always say to band, what's always striking to me, and it's not fair to compare anybody to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
But, you know, so many young bands, and I did when I first start writing songs, you just play G, C, and D,
right,
and you make up some words.
Right.
And what's so astounding to me, to go back and listen to like Zeppelin, and I go, man, they didn't even write a song unless they had a guitar riff.
Right.
Or a bass line. Or a drum beat that was so great and so unique and singular, then they'd say, let's follow that.
Right.
Jimmy Page, you didn't sit there and just strum a guitar and mumble some lyrics and say,
right.
man, you know, I'll put a drum on. Man, they just had...
Right. It was a band in the truest sense of the word.
They had something like that. I mean, the Pretenders have a lot of that.
Absolutely.
They got this... I mean, that bass line on
yeah.
My City Was Gone. Just
right.
a... I can't tell you how much it'd blow my mind
yeah, man.
To have a band of 20-year-old guys come in here and say, man, Phil, this first track starts with just the bass. It just goes... I would
yeah.
just go, holy crap, that's great. You know, I mean,
right.
they're not all, hey, man, it's just A. And that's not to put what anybody's doing down, but
right.
I would just implore guys writing songs or something these days. And I try this in my own stuff, but it gets frustrating because I get into a lyric or something, and I'm like, I go back and go, gosh, maybe we could have spent more time you know, with that little riff, just really making it a singular thing, like that Zeppelin song or the Pretenders. Those singular riffs are very rare, you know?
Yeah, well, that's part of the craft, and that's part of the learning, I think, experience that, you know, has been kind of devalued in this in the way the music world operates. You know, it's a world
right.
of singles and a world of, you know, a sound bite, and it's a world of getting on the hills or on an MTV
yeah,
show or
that's
something
right.
like that. And
which all you got to do is just go down, 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 down. If you did that today or some version of it, it'd get people's attention, wouldn't it? I mean, just like Day Tripper, like, you know, like a
sure.
But something like, just with those notes, I mean, put together, that you don't hear a whole lot of songs with just a singular line, you know?
Right, and that gets back to the craft of it. I mean,
yeah.
you know, you're talking about, well, that's just A.
Yeah, right.
But if you make A interesting,
that's right.
Then
that's
it's right. a totally different, you know, it's a totally different world. And that's, like I said, Little Steven had a, you know, great speech at South by Southwest where he just dogged rock and roll music right now.
Is that on YouTube or something like
that?
Yeah,
it's on YouTube as well. There's,
I need to check
that out.
There's
transcripts of it online. You can find it.
I was a big fan of Little Steven's Underground Garage.
Underground Garage, that's right.
Dude, he told great stories. Man, talk about a guy who knows music.
Right.
Holy cow.
Right, and he pointed it out, like I said, you know, you're talking about
all those
about
bands that you don't know, those with the crazy names from the 60s, all those
yeah.
surf bands. I mean, he knows everything.
He knows it all. And that's part of the point he was trying to make. Like the Pretenders, you know, when you listen to them, you can hear a lot of the influences from the 70s.
That's right, yeah.
And the way they put things together. And the same way with any of these bands, any of these great records we talked about, you can hear their influences if you're listening. And the thing about it is everyone's musical vocabulary right now in the music industry is pretty limited.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, we talk about the genre of country. Well, I only listen to country music. Well, shit, if you listen to rock and roll music, you'll find out that a lot of the beats that Hank Williams Sr. was involved in, you find them all just
yeah.
rife throughout
rock and roll
music.
And yeah, that's right.
And it's all an evolution and, you know, influences on top of influences. And,
yeah.
you know, I hope that, you know, a lot of people that are out there today will start to go back and embrace just the varieties of music there are, because you're talking about finding your own voice. I don't
yeah.
think you can find your own voice until you've heard a lot of other voices.
That's right. That's right.
Because
There's
you
no
have
doubt
no
about it.
You have no perspective. You have no idea what's really out there until you go out and look for it and listen to it.
Yeah. It is true. I think you have to some of the great musicians are the real historians of music. You read. I saw an interview on PBS, Charlie Rose or something with Robert Plant when he did yep. the Alison Krauss deal. Man, he starts talking about you. I mean, it'd be easy to see Robert Plant. He's just some old hippie guy, you know, screaming. You know, what does he know? Dude, he knew every blues singer that's ever walked the earth.
Well, I mean,
he knew everything, and how they sang, and stylistically, and how they differed.
Right.
And he'd say, "Man, that's what I was doing on Physical Graffiti, was to get back to that sort of Blind Lemon Jefferson sound."
Right.
You know, I'm just like, man, this guy knows music,
right?
Man.
And that's the interesting thing about it is that, you know, it doesn't. It's not like. It's almost become a badge of dishonor, like if you play a cover song at a show.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at all the great bands, the Beatles, they
oh.
were a skiffle cover band when they
oh,
started.
Oh, man, yeah.
That's all
and
that
play,
they were.
And played covers forever. I mean, you know.
For a long, five
roll
years.
Over, roll over Beethoven and Twist and Shout.
For 5 years.
And they're all covers.
And the clubs
yeah.
in England, they played
yeah.
cover songs.
Oh, yeah.
Zeppelin's guys, all those guys came out of these cover bands that were playing stuff from mm-hmm. the States and in the 60s and stuff that was coming out. I mean, all those guys were. Or they
Many?
Were all involved in the blues or whatever.
Right.
You know, people, they had developed their craft before right. they started doing their own thing.
Well,
you
got to become a master of those existing
paradigms
or something.
Kind of an apprenticeship of sorts.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's kind of missing right now.
I think
that's what Little Steven was trying to point
yeah.
out.
I went to a museum in Madrid one time, and they said, man, we're going to see this Picasso exhibit. And I was excited. Of course, I had the Guernica, you know, the big gigantic mural with the, you know, the horse and that. Yeah, it was kind of at the end of it. But they said, man, there's some of his early works. So I'm expecting to see people with an eye in the middle of their forehead or something.
Right.
Or the blue cubism stuff. And it's just portraits of
right.
people. It's just a gentleman sitting in a chair. And very realistic.
Right.
It's still life, fruit. I'm like, what the heck's this? I thought I was seeing a Picasso. This, I mean, it was what he was painting when he was 16, 17.
Right.
When he was a young man.
Right.
And I was like, oh. And man, that's just like what you were saying with Zeppelin or these old bands. You master. And he got bored with that at some point. And at some point, man, he really broke out.
Right.
And that's the real artistic
and that's
thing.
Right. That's where they.
And
real...
a challenge for any young band out there.
Right.
If you think you don't need to really understand Yeah, I had a kid, and I told somebody, you were talking about, and he didn't really like Dylan, you know. He goes, he's not really my type. But, man, you know who I really do like? It's like Chris Knight. Like, he's brilliant. And Chris Knight is a great songwriter. Right. But I kind of rolled my eyes. I go, dude, how can you sit here and say you like Chris Knight? You don't think Dylan's worth your time? Right. He goes, well, man, I just don't like any of his. And to each his own. But I kind of like, man, if you follow the Chris Knight trail, all these trails are going to lead through Dylan. And past Dylan, all the way back into the folk tradition. I go, man, but you got to kind of, you have to be a master in your own right or an artist. You've got to have an appreciation of that history, man. If you hear Bruce Springsteen talk about his art, or Rod Stewart, or Elton John, or any of these guys, they'll talk about guys, Robert Plant and the blues guys, that blow your mind. Like, God, how does he know so much about vaudeville, singers and right, piano players? Like, man, he mastered that. He knows music.
Yeah, and all these guys, take Nirvana, for instance. Nirvana just really showed up on the scene all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is, and Kurt Cobain, and when he did that MTV Unplugged thing.
Yeah, yeah.
He played like three or four
Pixies. The Meat Puppet stuff.
He played a bunch of Pixie songs.
Yeah,
and you're
right.
Like, well, wait a minute. I thought he was singular and stood on his own. Then you go back and you listen to the Pixies and you realize.
Oh, and the Meat Puppets, and you see where it all came from.
You see exactly where he started his evolution. He started his evolution with the Pixies.
Yeah, that's right.
And you see a lot of now that he's dead, all this early stuff and these old crazy recordings where mm-hmm. he's staring at the wall and, singing to the wall while the rest of the band's jumping around this living room, And you're hearing him playing the Pixies and all these other songs, and then you realize, well, these guys, they aren't as original as I thought, but they're still every bit as original as I thought.
That's right. That's right.
And I think that art has been lost a little bit.
Yeah. Well, we talk about it a lot on the podcast. Man, you gotta dig in out there, man. If you're really gonna get into music, either as a fan or as an artist, man, dig in. So we try to on the What's on Phil's iPod. I'm always amazed by people who come in the studio and pick up an album by Willie Nelson, an old Willie Nelson album, or a Pretenders album, or a Dylan album. And say, what's this? Or, man, why do you have Rod Stewart in here, man? He's kind of weird. And I'm kind of, dude, you haven't heard like Every Picture Tells a Story or
Rod Stewart,
Tumbleweed Connection by Elton John.
Some of these old songs. Go back to the Faces.
Yeah. So, man,
Ronnie Wood was in that band.
That's right, man. Add the Pretenders, man.
Learning
to Crawl, a great starting point. They got Pretenders 1 and 2, also great, great albums. Man, you'll be surprised how much of it you already know or you already heard. And great rock and roll, man. So if you're out there trying to, feast and survive and thrive in the Texas music world out there, man, pick up some of those Pretender songs. Work up a cover of Middle of the Road, man. Just kick out the jams and Beaumont some night.
See a band.
That'd be cool, wouldn't it? Just
if I walked into Adair's one night and some bands up there
just doing Tom the Avenger.
Man, I would be. I'm telling you, man.
I'd jump on stage. I'd just go. I'd blow my mind. Blow my
mind. I'd go crazy.
Oh, it'd just be great. Well, Buddy Huffman, thanks for being here.
Phil, thank you, brother.
Go to MakingGrayson.com. Catch up with Making Grayson. They're playing all over the country. Pick up their records. Can you buy the stuff on site? iTunes? Where is all the stuff?
Our website's really just conflagration of links.
That's right.
They go to Twitter and MySpace and Facebook and all that stuff. So, you can order albums online through iTunes or all the outlets like that. If you want a physical record, there's a few places I think you can get it. And, of course, you can just email the band.
Yeah.
And we'll point you out. We'll point you in the direction.
Mail order. Got that mail order
business
going,
man. We'll point you in the direction. Yeah. Like Amazon, I think, has got some. And
sure.
People like, some of the online box stores have it. So.
Absolutely, man. MakingGrayson.com. Of course, you can get all my stuff at PhilPritchard.com. P2 Tunes. You can get it all for $4 an album. Or get the drop card, man. $20. You can get everything MP3 format, everything we've ever recorded. Well, thank you, Buddy Huffman, for being here. For Buddy, I'm Phil Pritchett signing off on this edition of the podcast. We will be back here next week and on Wednesday, RadioFreeTexas.org. Join us then for more insight, fun, and music discussion. Until then, take care. I wonder where your mind